Much as we suppress that which we find distasteful in ourselves, so we may fail to give ourselves credit for our best qualities. To face the truth also means acknowledging and celebrating our strengths. For millennia, sages have understood that the ultimate spiritual challenge is to wake up. In classical times, the Greeks wrote two exhortations into the side of Mount Parnassus. Know thyself is the most celebrated. The second translates roughly as, know all of thyself, a recognition that we must look beneath the surface to find the truth. Other modern thinkers have echoed this message. Writes psychiatrist Edward Whitmont, it is not until we have truly been shocked into seeing ourselves as we really are, instead of as we wish or hopefully assume we are, that we can take the first step toward individual reality. When he first came to see us, Roger B. thought of himself as honest and straightforward. His inclination, however, was to put a positive spin on his own experience. This, we find, is very common. In the face of relentless demand, we become so acclimated to a chronic state of mild anxiety and moderate discontent that we accept it as the status quo and forget what it's like to feel any differently. Alternatively, we go into denial or numbness, insisting that things are fine, even when our expedient choices are undeniably self-destructive in the long term. In the course of our work and with the help of feedback from his colleagues, Roger discovered a range of strategies that he used to deny or avoid taking responsibility for the more unpleasant and unacceptable aspects of his life. Blaming others and seeing himself as a victim was a big one. He attributed his troubles at work largely to the lack of attention from his boss and to the economic environment. He cited time pressures beyond his control as the explanation for why he didn't exercise or eat well or spend much time with his kids. Roger was also deft at rationalizing his unhealthy behaviors, aided by a dose of self-deception. We call this the not-dead-yet syndrome. What is the big deal, Roger told himself, about smoking a few cigarettes a week? It eventually emerged that the number was closer to a dozen. Or having a couple of drinks at the end of the long day. With clients, it often became three or four. Or putting on a few extra pounds, assuming that 20 pounds still counts as a few. When Roger felt guilty about some behavior, or overwhelmed by his circumstances, he tended to go to the other extreme. He would paint such a bleak, self-disparaging picture of himself that within a short time all he wanted was some way to push away all the discomfort, and thus the cycle of self-deception resumed. Above all others, denial was his drug of choice. Roger's strategies were scarcely the most extreme that we have encountered. A respiratory therapist we know, someone who worked in hospitals with patients who had emphysema and other similar illnesses, was recently diagnosed with lung cancer. It turned out that she'd been a smoker for 20 years. Extraordinary as it seems, she had managed to willfully resist tying her own behavior to the horrifying consequences of smoking that she had observed at work every day for more than a decade. Facing the truth requires making yourself the object of inquiry, conducting an audit of your life, and holding yourself accountable for the energy consequences of your behaviors. To get a quick overview, take out a piece of paper and a pen and set aside at least 30 quiet minutes to answer this series of questions. On a scale of 1 to 10, how fully engaged are you in your work? What's standing in your way? How closely does your everyday behavior match your values and serve your mission? Where are the disconnects? How fully are you embodying your values and vision for yourself at work, at home, in your community, and where are you falling short? How effectively are the choices that you are making physically, your habits of nutrition, exercise, sleep, and the balance of stress and recovery, serving your key values? How consistent with your values is your emotional response in any given situation? Is it different at work than it is at home? And if so, how? And finally, to what degree do you establish clear priorities and sustain attention on tasks? How consistent are those priorities with what you say is most important to you? Now, take this inquiry one step further and make it more open-ended. If energy is your most precious resource, let's look at how well you manage it relative to what you say matters most. How do your habits of sleeping, eating, and exercise affect your available energy? How much negative energy do you invest in defense spending, frustration, anger, fear, resentment, and envy, as opposed to positive energy utilized in the service of growth and productivity? How much energy do you invest in yourself, and how much in others? And how comfortable are you with that balance? How do those closest to you feel about the balance you've struck? How much energy do you spend worrying about, feeling frustrated by, and trying to influence events beyond your control? Finally, how wisely and productively are you investing your energy? If you took our earlier suggestion, you have already logged on to our website, filled out the full engagement inventory, and gotten back your results. Gathering this information can be painful, but also immensely revealing and ultimately very rewarding. The more data you have at your disposal, the better equipped you are to identify your 5 top performance barriers. When it comes to making changes in the way you manage your energy in the service of performance, these barriers will help you guide your choices about what new, positive rituals to build in your life. Here are the common performance barriers: low energy, impatience, defensiveness, critical of others, low stress tolerance, moody and irritable, poor team player, inflexible and rigid, unfocused, anxious, poor time management, lack of trust in others, lack of integrity, indecisive, poor communication skills, poor listening skills, lack of passion, low self-confidence, lack of empathy, overly dependent, poor work-life balance, negative and pessimistic thinking. Another way that we deceive ourselves is by assuming that our view represents the truth when it is really just an interpretation, a lens through which we choose to view the world. Without realizing it, we often create stories around a set of facts and then take our stories to be the truth. Just because something feels real doesn't make it so. The facts in a given situation may be incontrovertible, but the meaning that we ascribe to them is often far more subjective. In the aftermath of a meeting that he had spent weeks trying to arrange, Toby B., a salesman for a computer company, left feeling very encouraged about the prospects for closing a major deal. The next day, he wrote his potential customer a follow-up email and suggested a second meeting. After several days, he had received no response. He wrote a second email, and this time, a week went by with no response. Toby decided to call, and he left his prospective customer a voicemail. Once again, no answer. Now Toby's story began to kick in, a variation on one that he had told himself many times before in the face of discouragement. "Obviously, this guy isn't interested after all," he concluded. "I was just kidding myself about how well the original meeting went. I must have screwed up in some way. I've had this happen a lot of times lately, and there's obviously something wrong with the way I'm selling." Feeling frustrated and slightly humiliated, he decided not to follow up again. 2 weeks went by, and over dinner one night, Toby recounted his story to his friend Gail. She had a totally different interpretation of the same set of facts. "Isn't it true that you've made several big sales in the last 6 months?" she asked. "You've told me yourself that these are big-ticket items you're trying to sell, and it never happens quickly. If this guy seemed enthusiastic after you left the meeting, I'm sure he really was. He probably just got really busy and it dropped off his radar screen. Why don't you wait another week and write him an email as if you're following up for the first time?" Reluctantly and skeptically, Toby took Gail's advice. 10 minutes after he sent the new email, he received a response from his prospective customer. "Apologies," it began. "I forgot to mention that I was just leaving for a 2-week vacation when we met. I'm still enthusiastic. Let's set up a meeting to take the next steps." Toby had allowed himself to be defeated by the story he told himself rather than by the truth. His friend, fortunately, found a more motivating way to look at the same situation, which helped transform Toby's attitude and the quality of his energy. It is both a danger and a delusion when we become too identified with any singular view of ourselves, for better or for worse. We open to a more complete picture when we can step back and develop the capacity for self-observation. By broadening our perspective, we can become the audience for the drama in our lives, rather than becoming identified with the drama itself. The practice of Vipassana meditation is sometimes referred to as witnessing, observing our thoughts, feelings, and sensations without getting caught up in them. As the psychiatrist Robert Assagioli puts it, we may move from a feeling of, I am overwhelmed by my anxiety, to the more dispassionate, my anxiety is trying to overwhelm me. In one, we are victims. In the other, we have the power to make choices and take action. If the truth is to set us free, facing it cannot be a one-time event. Rather, it must become a practice. Like all of our muscles, self-awareness withers from disuse and deepens when we push past our resistance to see more of the truth. We fall asleep to aspects of ourselves each and every day. Much as we must keep returning to the gym and pushing weight against resistance in order to sustain or increase our physical strength, so we must persistently shed light on those aspects of ourselves that we prefer not to see in order to build mental, emotional, and spiritual capacity. The Serenity Prayer is a perfect primer on ideal energy management. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We spend vast quantities of energy worrying about people and situations over which we have no control. Far better to concentrate our energy on that which we can influence. Facing the truth helps us to make that distinction. To the degree that our sense of self-worth is fragile, opening to unpleasant information about ourselves can feel threatening. We need courage to jump into the unknown, but also compassion for our resistance to accepting what we discover. We must keep moving deliberately in the direction of truth, recognizing that the forces of self-protection will slow our progress at times. As we clear our sight lines, we become more aware of the blocks that stand in our way. Facing the most difficult truths in our lives is challenging, but also liberating. When we have nothing left to hide, we no longer fear exposure. Vast energy is freed up to fully engage in our lives. We celebrate our strengths and continue to build them. When we make a misstep, we take responsibility for it and reset our course.
The final step in our change process is taking action. Ivan Lendl was far from the most physically gifted tennis player of his era, but for 5 years he was the number one ranked player in the world. His edge was in the routines that he built. It is no surprise that Lendl practiced long hours on the court, or even that he did so at very precise times. What set him apart from other players on the tour was that he followed similar routines in every dimension of his life. He developed a rigorous fitness regimen off the court, which included sprints, middle-distance runs, long bicycle rides, and strength training. He did regular ballet bar exercises to increase his balance and grace. He adhered to a low-fat, high-complex carbohydrate diet and ate at very specific times. Lendl also practiced a series of daily mental focus exercises to improve his concentration and regularly introduced new ones to assure that they remain challenging. At tournaments, he gave clear instructions to family and friends not to burden him with the issues that might distract him from his mission. Whatever he did, he was either fully engaged or strategically disengaged. He even meticulously scheduled his time for relaxation and recovery, which included recreational golf, daily afternoon naps, and regularly scheduled massages. On the court, during matches, he relied on another set of rituals to keep himself centered and focused, including visualizing entire points before playing them and following the same multiple-step ritual each time he stepped up to the line to serve. As longtime rival John McEnroe later said, "Much as I may have disliked him, I have to give Lendl credit. Nobody in the sport has ever worked as hard as he did." Ivan wasn't the most talented player, but his dedication, physical and mental, was incredible, second to none, and he did it all through rehearsal. Tiger Woods is the modern version of Lendl, albeit with considerably more talent, but with the same fierce dedication to rituals for managing energy in all dimensions of his life, physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual. The payoff is clear. By his early 20s, Woods had not only become simply the best at what he does, but also the most consistently dominating golfer in the history of the game. It is perfectly logical to assume that Lendl excelled in part because he had extraordinary will and discipline. That probably isn't so. A growing body of research suggests that as little as 5% of our behaviors are consciously self-directed. We are creatures of habit, and as much as 95% of what we do occurs automatically or in reaction to a demand or an anxiety. What Lendl understood brilliantly and instinctively was the power of positive rituals, precise, consciously acquired behaviors that become automatic in our lives, fueled by a deep sense of purpose. Positive energy rituals are powerful on three levels. They help us to ensure that we effectively manage energy in the service of whatever mission we are on. They reduce the need to rely on our limited conscious will and discipline to take action. And finally, rituals are a powerful means by which to translate our values and priorities into action, to embody what matters most to us in our everyday behaviors. Like so many of us, Roger B. had become a prisoner of his own negative energy habits and routines. Many of those choices were expedient, strategies for quickly marshaling energy without regard to the long-term energy consequences. Skipping breakfast made it possible for Roger to get to the office earlier, but took no account of the effect that this choice had on his energy capacity throughout the morning. Drinking caffeinated coffee and diet colas was Roger's way of artificially pumping up his energy in the face of inadequate sleep. Not exercising was a consequence of Roger's inability to push himself physically when he felt so drained by other demands. It was difficult for Roger to imagine that once he built some endurance, exercising might actually be a source of renewal, not just physically after long hours at his desk, but also mentally and emotionally. Impatience and irritation were a means for Roger to vent his frustration, without regard for the toll that these negative emotions took on others and on his own energy reserves. Several drinks at night and the occasional cigarette were strategies Roger adopted to get immediate relief from stress, but they robbed him of energy in the short term and threatened his health in the long term. Keeping a certain distance from his wife and children was a means by which to avoid one more demand on his limited energy stores, but at a cost to the emotional nourishment that comes from close relationships. Above all, Roger had adopted by disengaging, conserving energy by not investing too much of it in anything or allowing himself to think too deeply about the choices that he was making. Roger's half-hearted attempts to change his behavior had been short-lived and ultimately unsuccessful. He was scarcely alone. Most of us are frustrated in our attempts to change, victims of the New Year's resolution syndrome in which we make firm commitments to new behaviors, only to quickly fall back into our familiar patterns. Rituals serve as anchors, ensuring that even in the most difficult circumstances, we will continue to use our energy in the service of values that we hold most dear. We are all exposed to storms throughout our lives, sickness and disease, the death of loved ones, betrayal and disappointments, financial setbacks and layoffs from jobs. These are the situations in which our character is truly tested, and our choices about how to manage energy are critical. Great performers, whether they are athletes or fighter pilots, surgeons or special forces soldiers, FBI agents or CEOs, all rely on positive rituals to manage their energy and achieve their goals. The same is true, we have discovered, of anyone whose life is grounded in clearly defined values. Authors of Rituals for Our Times, Yvonne Ember Black and Janine Roberts, write, "Every time we participate in a ritual, we are expressing our beliefs either verbally or more implicitly. Families who sit down to dinner together every night are saying without words that they believe in the need for families to have shared time together. Nightly bedtime rituals offer parents and children an opportunity to tell each other what they believe about all kinds of matters. The sheer act of doing the bedtime ritual expresses a belief in a certain kind of parent-child relationship where warmth and affection and safety are available." It is easy to dismiss as rigid and even extreme the highly structured routines of an athlete like Yvonne Lendl. But stop for a moment and think about the people you admire, or simply look at the areas of your life in which you are most effective and productive. If you are like most of our clients, you already have many rituals in place, often outside your conscious awareness. These may range from habits of hygiene, to planning for the day ahead, to routines with your family. Far from precluding spontaneity, rituals provide a level of comfort, continuity, and security that frees us to improvise and to take risks. Think of an athlete producing a seemingly impossible shot under fierce pressure. A highly trained surgeon making a critical, counterintuitive decision at a life-or-death moment during a delicate operation. Or an executive breaking an impasse in a difficult, former negotiation by suddenly coming up with a novel structure for a deal. Rituals provide a stable framework in which creative breakthroughs often occur. They can also open up time for recovery and renewal, when relationships can be deepened and spiritual reflection becomes possible. The limitations of conscious will and discipline are rooted in the fact that every demand on our self-control, from deciding what we eat to managing frustration, from building an exercise regimen to persisting at difficult tasks, all draw on the same small, easily depleted reservoir of energy. In a series of imaginative experiments, several researchers have demonstrated how this plays out in everyday life. In one study, for example, subjects were deprived of food for several hours and then exposed to a plate of chocolate chip cookies and other sweets. One group was given permission to indulge themselves. A second group was asked to refrain from eating sweets and to settle for radishes instead. The latter group succeeded in resisting the sweets, but then demonstrated significantly less persistence than the first group in a follow-up test trying to solve insoluble problems. In a second experiment, dieters who were presented with tempting food were able to control themselves but became significantly more likely to break the diet when faced with subsequent temptations. In still a third experiment, one group of subjects was asked to hold their hands under ice water for a specified period of time. They performed significantly worse on a series of subsequent proofreading tasks than a group that had not been subjected to the ice water challenge. The sustaining power of rituals comes from the fact that they conserve energy. "We should not cultivate the habit of thinking of what we are doing," wrote philosopher A.N. Whitehead back in 1911. The precise opposite is the case. Civilization advances by extending the number of operations which we can perform without thinking about them. In contrast to will and discipline, which imply pushing ourselves to action, a well-defined ritual pulls us. We feel somehow worse if we don't do it. Think about brushing your teeth or taking a shower or kissing your spouse goodbye in the morning or attending your child's soccer game or calling your parents on a weekend. If we want to build into our lives new behaviors that last, we can't spend much energy to sustain them. Since will and discipline are far more limited and precious resources than most of us realize, they must be called upon very selectively. Because even small acts of self-control use up this limited reservoir, consciously using this energy for one activity means it will be less available for the next one. The sobering truth is that we have the capacity for very few conscious acts of self-control in a given day. Much as it is possible to strengthen a bicep or a tricep by subjecting it to stress and then recovering, so is it possible to strategically build the muscle of self-control. The same training regimen applies. Exercise self-control or empathy or patience past normal limits, and then allow time for rest, and these muscles become progressively stronger. More reliably, however, we can offset the limitations of conscious will and discipline by building positive rituals that become automatic and relatively effortless as quickly as possible. The most important role of rituals is to ensure an effective balance between energy expenditure and energy renewal in the service of full engagement. All great performers have rituals that optimize their ability to move rhythmically between stress and recovery. My discovery of the between-point recovery rituals used by nearly all top tennis players is an especially vivid example. In just 16 to 20 seconds, these highly precise rituals prompt a remarkably efficient form of recovery. The same stress recovery balance is critical in any venue that demands performance. The more precise and effective our energy recovery rituals, the more effectively we can restore our energy reserves. We have done a great deal of work with Wall Street traders, for example, who must sit in front of their computer terminals for long hours each day and have very limited time for breaks. When we first suggested that they needed to build more recovery rituals into their days, they laughed at us. "We barely have time to go to the bathroom," they told us. "How are we going to take time for recovery?" We reminded them how quickly and efficiently athletes are able to recover and pointed out that even structured 60 to 90 second breaks throughout the day could provide a great deal of renewal. With our encouragement, they began devising their own rituals. These ranged from 60 seconds of deep breathing to putting on a Walkman and listening to a favorite song, from making a quick call home to check in and connect with a spouse or a child, to walking up and down four flights of stairs, from playing a video game on the computer screen to eating an energy bar. The more scheduled and systematic these rituals became, the more renewal they provided. Peter D. is a writer who sought our advice at a time when he was facing a highly challenging book deadline that he wasn't sure he could meet. For years, Peter was used to putting in long, continuous hours at his word processor. The problem, he told us, was that he found it hard to maintain his concentration, particularly as the day wore on. Our goal was to help him to shift from the mentality of a marathoner to that of a sprinter. We worked with Peter to develop rituals that alternated periods of intense engagement with relatively short but highly structured periods of recovery. Because Peter told us that he felt freshest in the early morning, we had him begin his workdays at 6:30 a.m. and write for 90 minutes before he did anything else. To minimize distraction, he agreed to turn off his phone, not to check his email during his writing hours. At 8 a.m., Peter stopped to have breakfast with his wife and three children. We also suggested he shift from his previous routine of eating a bagel or a muffin and a glass of orange juice to the more sustaining energy of a protein drink. Peter returned to work at 8:30 a.m. and wrote without interruption until 10. At that point, he took a 20-minute recovery break, 10 minutes of training with light weights, followed by 10 minutes of meditation. He also ate a piece of fruit or a handful of nuts before heading back to his desk. Peter's third writing session went from 10:30 until noon, at which time he went jogging and then ate lunch. During those 4.5 hours of focused morning work, Peter was able to write nearly twice as much as he had, sitting at his desk for up to 10 hours a day in previous years. In the afternoons, he turned his attention to reading and research for the book and to other business. In the evenings, feeling good about his productivity, but also reasonably rested, Peter still had energy to focus on his family.
Rituals also help us to create structure in our lives. More than ever, we are bombarded by competing options and choices, endless information, and infinite demands. As one top executive at a leading financial firm told us, "The biggest problem in American business today is the feeling that nothing is ever finished. There's no satisfaction to be derived from a job well done because there's always another demand to be met. We're all running on an endless treadmill." Rituals create boundaries, clearly delineated opportunities to renew and refuel, but also to take stock and to prepare for the next challenge. Each time that Ivan Lendl stepped up to the line to serve during a tennis match, he predictably wiped his brow with his wristband, knocked the head of his racket against each of his heels, took sawdust from his pocket, bounced the ball 4 times, and visualized where he intended to hit the ball. In the process, Lendl was recalibrating his energy, pushing away distraction, calming his physiology, focusing his attention, triggering re-engagement, and preparing his body to perform at its best. In effect, he was programming his internal computer. When the point began, the program ran automatically. Successful executives, managers, and salespeople often have their own pre-performance rituals. In advance of an important meeting, these rituals might range from taking a walk in order to shift gears, to abdominal breathing in order to relax, from rehearsing the key points to be covered to reciting a series of affirmations around desired outcomes. In addition to creating continuity, rituals help to facilitate change. For thousands of years, rituals have been used to take account of our accomplishments, give thanks for our blessings, and facilitate the transition from one stage to another in our lives. We mark rites of passage with the Bar Mitzvah in Judaism, the Confirmation in Christianity, and with celebrations around birthdays, anniversaries, and graduations. Holiday rituals such as Thanksgiving and Christmas provide opportunities to give thanks, to take stock, and to reconnect with loved ones. Weddings mark the movement from single to married life, simultaneously celebrating the promise of the future while acknowledging the momentousness of the transition. More broadly, rituals imbue certain key events in our lives with meaning. Unfortunately, many of us have negative associations with rituals. In part, this may be because rather than freely being chosen, they were imposed upon us early in our lives. When a ritual begins to feel empty, stale, and even oppressive, the likely explanation is that it has lost its connection to deeply held values. To keep rituals alive and vibrant requires a delicate balance. Without the structure and clarity they provide, we are forever vulnerable to the urgent demands in our lives, the seductions of the moment, and the limits of our conscious will and discipline. On the other hand, if our rituals become too rigid, unvarying, and linear, the eventual consequence is boredom, disengagement, and even diminished passion and productivity. Our dual challenge is to hold fast to our rituals when the pressures in our lives threaten to throw us off track, and to periodically revisit and change them so that they remain fresh. It is critical, for example, to create structured workouts as part of any weight training regime. However, if you continue to challenge the same body parts in the same way, you will eventually stop gaining strength, become bored and frustrated, and likely quit. Healthy rituals straddle the territory between the comfort of the past and the challenge of the future. Used to best advantage, rituals provide a source of security and consistency without thwarting change or undermining flexibility. There are several key elements in building effective energy management rituals, but none so important as specificity of timing and precision of behavior during the 30 to 60 day acquisition period. Ted D. and his wife Donna went through our program together. Like many of our clients, they complained that because their lives were so busy, they had little time for one another. As it happened, they also worked together, running a mail-order catalog business. Most of their conversations, on and off the job, focused either on business or on dealing with the demands of their three teenage children. Ted and Donna decided to build a ritual around setting aside an hour and a half of uninterrupted time for one another on Saturday mornings. The first time that the designated day arrived, both of them had a couple of other pressing items to take care of first. By the time they were ready to sit down, an hour had passed. Just as they were about to start, one of their kids awakened and wanted a ride to an athletic event. Before they knew it, the pressing nature of the day overcame their commitment to spend time together. When much the same thing happened the second week, Ted suggested that they set a specific start time, 8 a.m., and make it sacrosanct. They agreed not to answer the phone during their time together, and they asked their kids not to interrupt them. It worked immediately. Within a few weeks, however, a second issue emerged. Because Ted was more aggressive in talking about what was on his mind, he tended to take up the majority of their time together. To solve the problem, they agreed that Donna should go first and that for the first 45 minutes they would talk about whatever was on her mind. Then they switched roles and Ted took his turn. When we last spoke to them, it had been more than 2 years since they launched the ritual, and they had missed it perhaps a half dozen times. It had become deeply woven into the fabric of their lives, and both of them agreed that it had been a central factor in helping them to feel closely connected no matter how busy the rest of their lives became. Doug L. is an executive who spent nearly a decade overseeing several thousand financial advisors at a large financial services company. From early on, he instinctively understood the role of rituals. To assure that he embodied the values he had defined as important and the goals he had set for himself, he developed a series of what he called key behaviors. In his personal life, these included a weekly date night with his wife and a commitment to attend all of his daughter's athletic events. One of the more unusual rituals, for an executive at his level, was that on Wednesdays at 1 p.m., he left his office to play tennis for an hour, and on Fridays at 1 p.m., he played basketball for 90 minutes at a nearby YMCA. His secretary put these two dates in his weekly calendar and protected them the way she would any other high-priority appointment. For Doug, these two activities were critical sources of renewal in the course of his very demanding days. If he had been more casual about trying to find the time to exercise in the middle of work days, he told us, it never would have happened. The same was true of the date night with his wife and of the time he committed to his daughters. A broad and persuasive array of studies confirms that specificity of timing and precision of behavior dramatically increase the likelihood of success. The explanation lies once again in the fact that our conscious capacity for self-control is limited and easily depleted. By determining when, where, and how a behavior will occur, we no longer have to think much about getting it done. A series of experiments have confirmed this pattern. In one study, for example, participants were asked to write a report on how they intended to spend Christmas Eve and to submit it within 48 hours. Half of the participants were told to specify exactly when and where they intended to write the report. The other half got no such deadline. Among those who had the precise deadline, 75% handed the reports in on time. Only one-third of the second group did so. In another study, women were asked to perform a breath self-examination during the subsequent month. One group was asked to write down when and where they would do so, while the other was not. Both groups were then narrowed down to those women who had expressed a strong intention to complete the task. Nearly 100% of those who designated when and where they would do the exam completed it. Only 53% of the second group did so, despite equally strong intentions to conduct the exam. In still a third study, the goal was to increase compliance in a fitness program that was being offered to a group of non-exercising college students. In a first attempt to motivate them, the subjects were given data about how exercise would significantly reduce their vulnerability to coronary heart disease. Participation in the program increased from 29 to 39%. When this information was followed by a request that students designate when and where they intended to exercise, compliance jumped to a remarkable 91%. Similar results were achieved in trying to help people adopt better eating habits. Participants proved far more likely to eat healthy, low-calorie foods when they were asked in advance to specify precisely what they intended to eat for each of their meals during the day, rather than using their energy to resist eating certain foods all day long. In perhaps the most dramatic study of all, a group of drug addicts were studied during withdrawal, a time when the energy required to control the urge to take drugs severely compromises their ability to undertake nearly any other task. As part of the effort to help them find employment post-rehabilitation, one group was asked to commit to writing a short resume before 5 p.m. on a particular day. Not a single one succeeded. A second group was asked to complete the same task, but also to say exactly when and where they would write the resume. 80% of that group succeeded. The specificity and precision of rituals also makes it more likely that we will be able to produce them under pressure. Bill Walsh, the brilliant former coach of the San Francisco 49ers, put it simply in describing his approach to football. At all times, he said, the focus must be on doing things properly. Every play, every practice, every meeting, every situation, every time. Walsh's point applies to any performance venue. Practice makes perfect only if the practice is perfect, or at least aims for perfection. If you cannot perform a particular task effectively when you're feeling relaxed and unpressured, it's unlikely that you'll be able to do so when the pressure is high, or when you're in the midst of a crisis. Building precise rituals makes it possible to push away the distractions and fears that arise under pressure. The less thinking people have to do under adverse circumstances, the better, explains Walsh. When you're under pressure, the mind can play tricks on you. The more primed and focused you remain, the smoother you can deal with out-of-the-ordinary circumstances. Precision and specificity also help to assure that our rituals themselves remain fueled by our deepest values. It is not enough to simply create a vision statement. Only by building a ritual to regularly revisit this vision can we ensure a strong, continuing connection to the unique source of energy such a statement provides. Pediatric neurosurgeon Ben Carson is a good example. I have found that having a morning ritual, meditation or some quiet reading time, can set the tone for the whole day, he explains. Every morning I spend a half hour reading the Bible, especially the book of Proverbs. There's so much wisdom there. During the day, if I encounter a frustrating situation, I think back to one of the verses that I read that morning. Take Proverbs 16:32, for example. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit is better than he who takes a city. Our clients have found their own rituals to maintain their connection to the energy of purpose. Some spend a few minutes when they wake up writing in a journal. Others meditate or pray or read something inspirational, or simply spend a few minutes in reflection while they're showering. Still others have their statements on the homepage of their computers, or make it a practice during breaks to reflect on their values. One client had his personal and professional vision laminated on two sides of an index card and slipped it under the visor above his seat in his car. On his way to work in the morning, he spent a few minutes reviewing his professional vision. On his way home at night, he flipped the card and spent the last few minutes of his commute reflecting on his personal vision. The key is not how we make the connection to our purpose. Rather, it's assuring that we do so in a regular way. When intentions are framed negatively, I won't overeat or I will not get angry, they rapidly deplete our limited stores of will and discipline. Not doing something requires continuous self-control. This is especially true of deeply ingrained habits and responses to temptations, such as eating desserts or drinking alcohol in a social situation. Designing a positive behavior to prepare for a particular situation is sometimes called priming. In the case of the temptation to overeat, for example, the priming ritual might be something like, when I'm tempted by dessert, I'll have a piece of fruit instead. For years, George F., an executive at a small consulting company, struggled with an inclination to lose his temper whenever he felt frustrated or thwarted. It undermined his relationships at work, and because he considered kindness a primary value, it also made him feel bad about himself. As we looked more closely, it became clear that George was especially vulnerable to blowing up when he had worked long hours without a break or failed to eat at regular intervals. Countless times he had committed to controlling his impulses, but within a few days he always found himself reverting to his familiar pattern. Ensuring breaks and eating regularly represented a first intervention. Next, we suggested that George focus on the behavior he wanted to introduce into his life rather than the one he hoped to resist. The first step was to get him to take several deep breaths as soon as he felt his anger rising, and to resist saying anything in the moment. When he finally did speak, we suggested that George lower his voice. He had a tendency to speak louder as he became more aroused, which not only fueled his anger, but also pushed others away. Finally, we asked George to smile, even if it required a bit of acting at first. Considerable evidence suggests that smiling literally reduces arousal and short-circuits the fight-or-flight response. It is nearly impossible to smile and to feel angry at the same time. Not surprisingly, George found this sequence of behaviors awkward and difficult at first. In several challenging situations, he simply forgot to do them at all. Within several weeks, however, the sequenced ritual had become nearly automatic in all but the most stressful of circumstances. What George found most startling was that smiling in the face of frustration actually became a trigger to view the situation differently, more gently, less urgently, and with a sense of humor. If nothing succeeds like success, it is equally true that nothing fails like excess. Because change requires moving beyond our comfort zone, it is best initiated in small and manageable increments. Imagine that you decide, perhaps as a New Year's resolution, to finally get in shape and start paying more attention to your physical health. Flush with resolve and enthusiasm, you join a gym and make a commitment to jog and to work out with weights 3 times a week. In the same spirit, you vow to begin a diet, reducing your caloric intake by half and cutting out all sugars and simple carbohydrates. Finally, you commit to getting more sleep at night and to waking up an hour earlier each morning. You even make very specific and precise plans about how to initiate your new program. Within 10 days, your diet has failed, you've only gotten to the gym twice, and you haven't changed your sleeping habits at all. What happened? The answer is that you took on too much too quickly. Overwhelmed by the demands on your limited will and discipline, you rapidly depleted your self-regulatory reservoir. The result is not just that you failed to stick to your plan, but that you also likely fed your belief that it is impossible to change lifelong habits. Our method is to build rituals in increments, focusing on one significant change at a time and setting reachable goals at each step of the process. If you've been completely sedentary and want to begin exercising, it doesn't make sense to start by trying to jog 3 miles a day, 5 days a week. Your odds of success are far higher if you begin with a highly specific but carefully calibrated training plan. That might mean walking for 15 minutes a day, 3 times a week at first, with predetermined increases in time or pace built in for each subsequent week. Growth and change won't occur unless you push past your comfort zone, but pushing too hard increases the likelihood that you will give up. Far better to experience success at each step of a progressive process. Building confidence fuels the persistence to pursue more challenging changes. We call these serial rituals. Two behaviors we have found dramatically increase the likelihood of successfully locking in new rituals during the typical 30 to 60 day acquisition period. We call these behaviors basic training. They serve as the ground upon which successful rituals are most effectively built. Chart the course. This practice can take many forms, but the aim is always the same: to launch each day's ritual acquisition mission by revisiting our vision, clarifying not just what we intend to accomplish, but how we want to conduct ourselves along the way. Some of our clients find that they can do this in as little as 5 or 10 minutes, while others set aside a half hour or more. Some clients chart the course in the shower, while others sit in a quiet room at home or do it during a walk or a jog outdoors, or even while commuting to work. Charting the course may include different elements. Some clients find it most effective to connect to specific, deeply held values such as generosity, empathy, honesty, or confidence, and to use them as fuel for instituting a particular behavior or achieving a specific goal. Others find it most powerful to actively imagine how they will handle potentially difficult challenges in the day ahead. Still others simply like to set aside a designated block of time when they get up to reflect on their vision for themselves. This may take the form of writing in a journal or meditation or prayer. Sally F. worked at an inner-city public school. For all the idealism that drew her to teaching, she spent much of her day disciplining her students and trying to keep order in her classroom. She decided to institute a morning ritual to stimulate positive feelings about her work in order to offset frustration and to increase her positive energy. After completing our training, she began launching each day by reconnecting with the importance of her 4 primary values: patience, respect for others, gratitude, and humility. On stressful days, it had always been difficult for Sally to resist succumbing to negative emotions. Living by a code of conduct about how to manage her energy, establishing rules of engagement, grounded Sally in her deepest values and helped her to keep discouragement at bay. When her energy flowed more from a positive sense of appreciation for the opportunity that teaching provided, Sally not only felt more patient and balanced, but also found that she had a more uplifting and inspiring impact on her students. Chart the progress. The second key to building rituals that lead to sustaining change is holding yourself accountable at the end of each day. Accountability is a means of regularly facing the truth about the gap between your intention and your actual behavior. If you're trying to eat a healthier diet, it's critical to have rituals that define what and when you're going to eat, but also to measure at the end of each day how well you followed your plan. If you build a ritual around treating others with more respect, it is important to keep track of how effectively you're meeting that goal. The same is true for any endeavor to which you've committed yourself. Defining a desired outcome and holding yourself accountable each day gives focus and direction to the rituals that you build. For many of our clients, the best way to do this is to create a daily accountability log. This exercise can be as simple as a yes or no check on a sheet kept beside your bed. Holding your own feet to the fire doesn't require judging or punishing yourself when you fall short. Negative motivation, as we have seen, is short-lived and energy-draining. At its best, accountability is both a protection against our infinite capacity for self-deception and a source of information about what still stands in our way. If you are falling short in implementing a particular ritual or achieving the outcome that you are seeking, several explanations are possible. It may be that the ritual isn't grounded in a value or a vision that is truly compelling to you. It may be that the goal that you set is simply too ambitious and needs to be implemented more slowly and progressively. It could also be that the ritual you put in place is faulty and needs to be restructured. Often, the failure to follow through on a new ritual masks the benefit that you derive from holding on to an existing behavior and an unacknowledged resistance to changing it. Whatever the explanation, measuring your progress at the end of the day should be used not as a weapon against yourself, but as an instructive part of the change process. We can derive as much value from studying and understanding our failures as we can from celebrating and reinforcing our successes.
Roger B. was an unusually challenging client. It wasn't that his performance barriers were significantly more daunting than those we typically face. Rather, his initial motivation to change was so low. Not surprisingly, Roger arrived at our center with a chip on his shoulder. His boss had done his best to frame his visit to us as an opportunity, but Roger couldn't help but feel that he had been singled out. He was late getting his pre-training materials to us, he wore his skepticism openly throughout much of the first day, and he spent every break in our parking lot on his cell phone or answering emails on his BlackBerry. It was not an auspicious start. As Roger moved through our Face the Truth process, he was clearly unsettled by what he was hearing. We consider that a hopeful sign. Until clients feel some discomfort about their current circumstances, they are rarely inclined to change. The first surprise for Roger was his physical testing results. He had continued to think of himself as being in relatively decent shape, but he was relying mostly on past memories. It hadn't occurred to him how much atrophy occurs over 2 decades of relative inactivity. He was discouraged to find how high his body fat percentage was and how low his cardiovascular capacity and strength were. He was also shocked when we told him that his risk factors, elevated blood pressure, relatively high alcohol consumption, chronic high stress, moderate smoking, high cholesterol, and excess weight, made him a prime candidate for an early heart attack. It was true, he acknowledged, that his doctor had encouraged him to lose weight and to exercise more regularly, but Roger had never sensed there was any real urgency. He was also surprised and a bit defensive about some of the feedback he received from colleagues on his full engagement inventory, most notably that they found him to be highly critical, impatient, and short-tempered. While Roger admitted that he felt irritable and negative at times, he believed that he hit it well and that he generally treated others with respect and kindness. "These are tough times," he explained. "I think a lot of my people just aren't used to being under the kind of pressures that we're facing, and they're blaming the messenger." Roger's first real breakthrough occurred when we asked him whether his wife or children would describe him as impatient and irritable. He seemed to visibly shrink in his chair. Just a few weeks ago, he told us, there had been an incident with Alyssa, his 9-year-old daughter. After picking her up at a Saturday gymnastics class, he had taken her out for lunch at a local restaurant, a rare occasion for the two of them to have time together alone. Alyssa was wearing a hand-knit sweater that Roger's mother had recently given her as a present. In the middle of lunch, Alyssa accidentally knocked over a glass of tomato juice and got it all over her new sweater. Roger reacted angrily, chastising his daughter for her carelessness. Alyssa tried to apologize, but Roger only became more angry. Eventually, she began to sob. "All you ever do is yell at me," she said between tears. "Why do you hate me so much?" It was as if she had put a knife to his heart, Roger told us. Instantly, he realized that he had overreacted, taking out on Alyssa all the frustration and anxiety he was feeling at work. Worse yet, he realized that his daughter was right about his behavior. In the relatively little time they spent together, he was often critical and impatient with her. The more we talked about it, the more he realized that the same was true with his younger daughter and with his wife as well. Perhaps, he told us, his colleagues were onto something about his behavior. For the work of defining purpose, Roger's first evening homework assignment was to answer a series of questions designed to help him surface his most deeply held values. As we noted earlier, one of the questions we ask is, jump ahead to the end of your life. What are the 3 most important lessons you have learned? Difficult as his life had become, Roger was not an especially complicated man. These were his answers. 1. Marry someone you love and respect and always make your family your highest priority. Everything else comes and goes, but your closest relationships are forever. 2. Work hard, keep your standards high, and never settle for anything less than you are capable of achieving. And 3. Treat other people with respect and kindness. The disparity between the story that Roger had told us the previous day and the lessons that he hoped to impart to his children didn't escape his notice. "I know I probably sound like a hypocrite," he said, "but even if I fall short, these really are the lessons I want to pass along to my kids." To the second query, think of someone you deeply respect. Describe the qualities you admire in this person. Roger chose his father, who, it turned out, had been a tailor and later owned a dry cleaning business. When it came to selecting his top 5 values, they weren't entirely surprising: kindness, excellence, family, integrity, and health. "I think the first 4 were all strongly influenced by my parents," Roger told us. "In all honesty, I probably wouldn't have put health on my list before doing this program. But I now see how much I've put myself at risk and what the consequences could be. Health seems a lot more important than it did before." The final step in defining purpose is to write a vision statement. This was Roger's. "My highest priority in life is my wife and my children. When we are together, I am committed to giving them all of my energy and attention. To make that possible, I must also take care of myself physically. At work, I hold myself to a high standard of excellence. As a leader, I model each of my primary values, most of all, kindness, concern for others, and integrity. I make others feel cared for and confident that they can count on me. Whatever I do wholeheartedly." When it came time to build an action plan, Roger focused both on his primary values and on the performance barriers he had identified: low energy, impatience, negativity, lack of depth in relationships, and lack of passion. He was reluctant to take on too much for fear of failing. We agreed. As we have pointed out, it is far better to succeed with small incremental changes and modest setbacks than to create a grand plan and fail completely. Roger decided to build his first set of rituals around increasing his physical capacity, not just to improve his health, but also on the theory that insufficient energy was a factor in every one of his performance issues. The first ritual Roger created was to work out at least 3 times a week, Tuesdays and Fridays at 1 p.m. and Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. He also committed to a healthy, high-protein breakfast every day and to eating smaller, more nutritious meals at regular intervals throughout the day. The second area in which he hoped to build a ritual was spending more time with his family. The best he could come up with by the time he finished our training was to try to leave work no later than 6:30 p.m. each day and to limit dinners with clients to no more than 2 a week. He wanted to talk with his wife before devising specific plans. Just making these changes, Roger believed, would have a significant impact on his energy, his relationships, and his attitude at work. After 2.5 days with us, he left feeling excited and enthusiastic about the challenge ahead. Just before getting on the plane home from his training, Roger checked in to see what awaited him at work. He had 134 emails, 45 voicemails, and a half dozen small work crises that demanded his attention. To his dismay, he barely had time to say hello to his wife and children on the evening that he returned. After a quick hello, he disappeared into his home office and turned his attention to putting out the fires at work. The next morning, he got up an hour earlier than usual and left before his family awoke, skipping his planned breakfast. Instead, he gobbled down a donut and coffee from the deli next to his office. Roger spent the next 4 hours juggling a dozen issues and trying to catch up on phone calls and correspondence. For lunch, he grabbed the most convenient item, 2 slices of pizza from the cafeteria, which he ate at his desk. His first scheduled midday workout went by the wayside, and he rescheduled it in his mind for the next day. He had promised Rachel that he would try to get home early after 3 nights away, but by the time he forced himself to leave work, it was already 7:30 p.m. On his commute home, feeling exhausted and discouraged, Roger began to brood. There was no way out, he decided. For all his optimistic plans, he was right back where he started. He wasn't going to arrive home before 8:30 p.m. He was certain that Raja would be angry with him, and he wasn't going to have much time or energy.